Blog Talk Radio.
What difference if I hail from north or south, or from the east or west? My heart is filled with love for all of these. I only know I swell with pride and deep within my breast I thrill to see, O glory faint, the breeze. This is my land of my birth. This is my country, grandest on earth. I pledge my allegiance, America, the bold. For this is my country to have and to
country. We've got 3 weeks before election. I hear the vote fraud's already started, and it's been going on. It's not covered in what we call the downstream press, even the alternative press. Excuse me. Still getting over that cold. We've just gotten over, we've just ended Fleet Week, Navy Fleet Week here in San Francisco. We had two Canadian ships here. It was the 100th anniversary of the Canadian Navy, and we're going to get those chaps who were born in Canada, who emigrated legally to the United States, joined our forces down here, people like Glenn Ford, Harold Russell, Victor Jory, people like that, and served us faithfully. And, of course, up on Amicus Veritas, AmicusVeritas, YouTube, is John Garan, the man behind the gun, which Sousa wrote a march about. He's the guy that invented the M1. He's a military engineer, never finished high school, and he emigrated from Quebec when he was a child, emigrated legally, and he worked in, I think, the Springfield Armory in Massachusetts. He signed over all of his patents to the United States government. That's how he repaid us, unlike some other slime balls that have come down here and taken advantage of Americans, especially servicemen like Stephen Nery and the Kevin Ryan scandal. But anyway, got quite a bit today. There's some interesting phenomenon that's occurred in San Francisco during Fleet Week. In years past, the sailors would be out all night drinking, carousing, seeing the sights even at night. And apparently, this is what I'm hearing, that because of the cover-up and the abuse and the attempted intimidation of people who were raising questions about this 15-year-old case, this kangaroo court case of Kevin Ryan, the Canadian, the slime ball that I talk about, who lied about how he entered the country from Canada, claimed that he was lived all his life in San Francisco, which would have to be an immaculate conception. Anyway, this sailor was on liberty from Alameda when the naval base was the Alameda Naval Air Station was in operation, and it's since been closed, and various aircraft carriers over there. And the kid came over the night of March 23rd, 1996, was drinking. He's part Native American. Family is Tidewater Indian. Mother is Tidewater Indian. His father was German, Dutch, and Irish ethnicity, Catholic and Baptist. And, of course, Native Americans do have to watch their drinking. Anyway, he was in the North Beach bar, and this homosexual predator, illegal alien, who had two prior arrests that we know about here in the United States, here in Northern California, fled his native Argentina, a prominent family, banking family, the oldest bank in Argentina. His specialty was preying on young white boys who were in the military, and used to lure people, young guys, to his apartment in a remote district of San Francisco and try to force them into S&M. And we know this from his lawyer, who lived downstairs from him and who had to defend him once at a case in which he came up to this 19-year-old boy and grabbed him by his genitals. And the kid fought back. And, of course, preyed on Stephen Neri, lured him to his house. We believe that he used the date rape drug because he was into drugs and pornography, male pornography. And the kid had never been in this situation before, sheltered kid, didn't even have a driver's license. And he seduced the kid. The kid was drunk and drugged. And the kid fought back when he tried anal rape. And because of the district attorney's political agenda of hiring homosexual and lesbian NAMBLA activists in the San Francisco District Attorney's Office, they used this case to show their opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And there was a corrupt and competent people on the USS Carl Vinson. There was a midnight interrogation when the San Francisco police came over to Alameda. No lawyer was present, as mandated by federal law, when a junior member of the military is questioned in a serious manner by a superior officer to protect that person's, the junior person's due process rights. A civil or lawyer or a JAG has to be present. Because the unusual circumstances of military life, where they are trained to respond immediately to commands and questions from a superior officer. So in a case like this, when they're charged with a serious crime or offense, such as homicide or assault or robbery, whatever, a JAG or a civilian lawyer has to be present. None was present, and this incompetent, corrupt NIS, Naval Investigative Service, a woman, Susan Krasner, participated in the forgery of federal papers to turn this kid out of the brig and turn him over to San Francisco authorities, who were not even in their jurisdiction. They were in Alameda County, and they were from San Francisco. Then there was a $2 million bail. All kinds of horrors, a broken hand. He never got medical care for that. That was sustained in fighting off the male rape. And then the guy's, the perpetrator's communicable disease status was concealed. His AIDS, he was a cocaine addict. That was concealed. His BD, TB, all these tests were concealed. The corpse was burned on April 1st, 1996. And the sailor had no Navy support. The Secretary of the Navy didn't know about this incident. The governor of California didn't know. The state attorney general didn't know. And the media covered up everything because Juan P. Ferre was supposedly one of them and was connected to the district attorney. So this story has been documented in part, provided the files, some of them, that I was able to release to Jack Cashel, who documented it in his book, What's the Matter with California, and there is a lot. So I recommend you get it. It's still available, the book. Part of it's up on the web, and we've been working on this case. We've had various volunteers, and it's been obstruction within the federal courts because we find out now that the federal courts, even the state courts, have been infiltrated and subverted by homosexual lesbian activists. And even the Supreme Court has finally realized that. There are articles coming out, even the New York Times, and we're going to put that up, their editorial about this political agenda in the courts. And this is what's happened, and I personally experienced it because I was the legal liaison for Stephen Neri to the U.S. Navy and to various government agencies and to Congress, because I knew about the case and had 40 years' experience with it. with P-Parade. Anyway, this story is getting around, this horror, and so the word is that these young sailors are being very careful. They're not out late at night. They're returning to their ships, and they walk in pairs usually to protect themselves, and that's what they used to do. There is no more shore patrol. I don't know what happened to it. So I hear the stories getting around, and that's the best thing because we don't need other sailors and Marines to be victimized. Incidentally, so far in California, there are at least 7 to 10 Marines who have been drugged, sexually assaulted, mutilated, and murdered, and their bodies dumped along the California coast. And the guy that did it, Randy Kraft, is sitting on death row in San Quentin, and his case is pending before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal because all death penalty cases have to go through the federal court if the convicted wants it. So that's where that's at. I don't want to dwell on this because there's a lot of other things that are important as well. But this is what's going on, so at least the word's getting around that these sailors have to, and Marines have to protect themselves because they're sexual predators out there, and in places like San Francisco, they are protected and even on the public payroll. This is also the 100th anniversary of the Canadian Navy, and in World War II, at the beginning of, in 1940, well, the war started September 1st, 1939, and Churchill and De Gaulle and the various countries that whose military and political leaders had fled to England to continue the fight against Hitler and Mussolini, and then, of course, Tojo in the Pacific, they looked to America to be the arsenal of democracy. But we didn't have the ships at that time, or we didn't have that many ships, and Admiral Dönitz of the German Navy had protected. He had been a submariner in World War One. And Hitler appointed him when, not Tirpitz, but Rader, who was a surface admiral. He replaced Rader with Dönitz, and then Dönitz developed this wolf pack submarine tactics against merchant ships that were sailing from Halifax, Nova Scotia in Canada, and from eastern ports here in America. And they didn't have a convoy system. They were sailing alone, and so they were easy pickings for the submarines. And so they developed a convoy system, but to protect these merchant ships, they needed warships to escort them safely and to ward off the wolf pack to get across from Halifax and the United States eastern ports to England. So the Canadians and the British came up with this ship called the Corvette, and that was a great Canadian contribution to World War II. And so we'll try to get into more of that. I've just been a little swamped. This is also another admiral 500 years earlier. It's called Admiral of the Ocean Sea. That was Christopher Colon Columbus. I think that was his middle name. We're not sure. There's some talk that he was Jewish, what they call a Morisco. We're not sure about that. Anyway, a lot of nativist scholars, a growing number of them, are critical of what the Spanish did here in the New World. And, of course, he never set foot on mainland America. In October 12, 1492, Columbus landed in what is known as, I think, the Bahamas. But what the Spanish did here, they came over here looking for gold, and the Indians didn't know what was going on. The Indians made, and the native peoples made, many contributions to Europe: tobacco, tomato, potato, corn, gold, which is what the Spanish were looking for. And when the Indians, they enslaved the Indians, and I regret this, they brought the Franciscan monks over with them, like Father Serra, he came later, and they used them to Christianize the savages and to herd them into these compounds. And if you ever come to California, you should stop and see a mission. It's quite interesting to see how this whole history of how the quote white man abused the native peoples, and there's an argument to be made there of abuse, and something should still be done to clean up this mess, and especially in the history books. Anyway, when the Indians and the native peoples held out on the gold, or were suspected of holding out, or not turning over all the riches, the gold and the jewels, that their hands were cut off, and if they were engaged and accused of homosexual practices, and this did occur, some of the tribes did engage in this, that they were, the dogs were set upon them, and they were mutilated. Now, this is interesting. The native peoples did not experience venereal disease until the Spanish came. And it is believed that the Spanish had sheep with them, and they were what we call having intercourse with the sheep, and this is where venereal disease in the New World is suspected of originating from the Spanish. And, of course, the Portuguese came later, and then they divided up what is known as the New World. So there's mixed feelings about Columbus, and, of course, Columbus was accused of high crimes and treason against the crown, and he was brought back to Spain. One of his, he had ancestors that lived into the late post-Franco era. Excuse me, Franco was the longest reigning dictator, one of the longest in the world, in the modern world, from 1936, I think, or 37, until the mid-70s. And there was a Spanish admiral named Christopher Colon Columbus, I believe it was his full name, and he was assassinated by suspected Basque separatists. This was about 20, 25 years ago. So, and that was one of the last male direct descendants or descendants of Christopher Columbus. So they maintain that nautical tradition in their family. Today also, since there's a lot of Navy things today, this week, is the, regrettably, the 10th anniversary of the terror attack on the USS Cole. It's interesting, we don't see much of this in the media, and I had forgotten about it, shame on me. I'll be watching Neil Cavuto on Fox, and it came up. And several of the families are very upset because our people apprehended this guy named Rahim Nashira, whatever, and he's supposed to be in jail, and charges, so they were supposed to try him, but they don't know where they're going to try him or what's going on. And when Obama came in into the White House, the charges against this alleged terrorist, the mastermind of the bombing of the Cole, which there were 17 sailors dead and 39 injured, and the ship was damaged and had to be brought back to be repaired, brought back to the States. Anyway, there's a lot of unhappy, upset families that they have the accused, and they're not trying him for these crimes against these sailors and against this terror attack on one of our ships. And, of course, there's a problem with Yemen because that seems to be a hotbed and a refuge for a lot of these terrorists who don't like Americans and the West. And, of course, one of the big lies, one of the political fictions, is that Islam is a peaceful religion. That's BS. And the whole history of that religion was enforcing their theological beliefs by force on, quote, non-believers. And you hear such terms as Christian dogs. Now, what that means, what my research turned up, is that because Christians didn't believe in circumcision, that this was part of that whole idea that dogs were unclean. And when the Islamists or the Muslims military captured, like the British or the French, if they weren't circumcised, they did a partial circumcision, and it was without anesthesia. And that's one of the origins of that phrase, Christian dog. And it's interesting that Muhammad, the founder of this religion, liked cats. And it is said that once a cat was sleeping on his gown, and rather than disturb the cat, he cut the area where the cat was sleeping and cut off part of his cloak so that the cat would not be disturbed from its slumber. So that's where that comes in. Interestingly, there's two dogs in that part of the world that are not in the category of dogs which are considered to be unclean, and that is the Saluki and the Afghan Hound. And it's very interesting. So that's a little history there. And let's see, what else? So I've got did some interviews with an articulate political scientist, former university president, an author, and one of his hobbies was entomology. It was Otto Butz, and I'm going to play, it's very relevant in this whole business of how we describe politicians, these animal illusions that are applied in politics. So here goes one of the interviews. There was three of them done. Here we go. Otto Butz and Animal Illusions.
Hello again, my friends. Welcome to part two of our inaugural inquiry into animal rights and people's language. My guest today, again, is the eminent Otto Butz, president of Golden Gate University and what we call the house entomologists around here. Otto, after an election, both print and electronic journalists continually use the trite phrase, lame duck politician. As a political scientist, Otto, do you think that these journalists are really saying that our politicians are impotent, ruptured, and babbling incoherence?
Well, I think to some extent, yes. A lame duck, I guess, is a duck that can't fly very high, that can't move very fast, and once a politician has lost the power to continue functioning and to dole out favors, the person's power is much reduced, and so the analogy of the lame duck isn't too bad at all.
Perhaps we ought to cook the duck like the Chinese.
Well, again, back to our previous discussion, it has nothing to do with the duck, but you see, you need analogies to describe human situations, and so you naturally turn around to nature, but the most interesting part of nature is the animal kingdom, and again, I think that it adds color. You could describe in a whole paragraph what happens to the politician. But if you say lame duck, somehow you dramatize it and you see this poor little critter.
I don't know about the politicians being poor.
Well, I tell you, politicians, I think, for the most part, don't get paid very much, and that's one of the problems of our time. I mean, to run a campaign costs you millions of dollars, and how are you going to get it? And that, you've got to be nice to people. And then we criticize others, but if we were to run for office, how would you finance all of that? So this is one of the dilemmas of our political life, you know, lame or non-lame ducks.
Although I must say some politicians do appear to be babbling constantly. Otto, for people who want to elevate the level of political rhetoric, would you have any practical suggestions?
Well, elevate political rhetoric. I mean, rhetoric is rhetoric, however elevated. You mean the political discussion. I think that the market more or less tends to determine the level of the rhetoric. If a politician is talking with thoughtful people with a sense of complexities, if she or he engages in stupid rhetoric, it's not going to fly. So the politician, if successful, as any merchandiser, has to attune himself or herself to the audience. On the other hand, if you've got a bunch of people who go for rhetoric, then the politician's going to play rhetoric. I think it's a question of supply and demand.
And on that, well, in this segment of the discussion on animal rights and language, I think that's very apropos. Tune in for part three, next edition at 10:25 a.m. Thanks for listening.
And another part of that great interview was on Machiavelli and politics.
Part three of our discussion with the president of Golden Gate University, author, lecturer, book reviewer, and entomologist. Otto, in Machiavelli's book, The Prince, he admonishes leaders to be both half man and half beast, or the fox and the lion. The fox to discover the snares and the lion to terrify the wolves. A ruler or a prince cannot successfully govern if he behaves only as one. As a political scientist, do you think that modern leaders have to govern in that manner?
Not so much. But remember, Machiavelli was writing in a day when political authority in modern Europe was only beginning to be established. There were feudal lords, there were people running around, challenging the existing order. And only shortly, well, around the time of Machiavelli, a Frenchman by the name of Baudin came up with the concept of sovereignty. There has to be a sovereign power as a framework within which political authority operates and with the final legitimation to make things happen or prevent it from happening. Today, to the extent that we have an established framework and political traditions, it is not necessary nor desirable that the leader be a lion, disguised sometimes, you know, as a sheep. However, if you look at Lebanon, for example, if you have a state of extreme anarchy, then you want someone who is going to be enough of a lion to bite the rear ends of anybody that is going to create havoc. And so I think Machiavelli would not say what he says today, because it isn't necessary. But in a situation like Thomas Hobbes talked about, the fact that if you don't have any sovereignty, some political authority, you have a war of all against all, in which he said life is solitary, nasty, brutish, and short, which it was in Lebanon. So I think you have to interpret Machiavelli in the context of his time.
Since we're on nationalism, Otto, do you attach any significance to the symbols of countries like the American eagle, the British lion, the Russian bear, the German eagle, anything like that? Do you attach any significance to that type of visual expression of nationalism?
One could, but I don't think I would too much, because, you see, when those symbols were chosen, there was still a certain gung-ho kind of attitude where people occasionally, you know, did have to do battle, and so the idea of this predatory beast which was fearless was sort of superficially appealing. You can imagine the drum and fife corps, and so it was sort of in retrospect a little boyish. On the other hand, if you and I were involved in struggles for survival, where we couldn't take for granted the kind of stable institutions and relatively stable world despite all of its problems, I think that we might also be driven, you know, to identify ourselves, as Indian tribes did, with some kind of an animal whose spirit somehow gave us extra impetus.
So do you think that in a way, since we've moved toward computers and you can fire laser beams hundreds of miles, that we've kind of dehumanized ourselves in a way? We've gotten so far away from nature because we don't relate to these symbols like the ancient tribes used to?
Well, I think in the short run, but if we were confronted with a real crisis, I think we would quickly revert to universal symbols. I somehow think that the human race and its glories and vulnerabilities stays the same regardless of computers and technology or anything else. I think the guy in Vietnam, either the Viet Cong or the American, I think in really crisis situations, what they thought of was what cavemen thought of. Somehow, I don't think human beings change, and I personally find that sort of reassuring.
I wish they changed towards animals.
Well, we are animals. We are animals. We are animals with a soul. And to understand this, you have to understand this in both capacities. And that's why our life is so complex compared with that of termites.
And continuing our ascent out of the cave, I want to leave you with this thought from Gertrude Steiner, one of our local poetess. A cat is a cat is a cat, and a dog is a dog is a dog. Now watch your language. Thank you, Otto, for being my guest today.
It was nice to be with you, Peter.
This is Peter Paul with another edition of So Sheep and Other Animals May Safely Graze. Tune in next week for another exploration. This is Peter Paul.
And these are from our archives of Western Public Radio and KALW. Since we're on the subject of politics, we'll continue down that line on these birthdays. Quite interesting birthdays today. Pearl Mesta. She was known as the Washington Society hostess, the hostess with the mostest, and there is a famous movie and a Broadway play by Cole Porter called Call Me Madam. It was starring Ethel Merman and wasn't the madam who provided young girls or young women to the politicians. At least I don't think she did. And Pearl was, Nesta was around the time of the Truman administration. And quite an interesting, it's a great show and movie, Call Me Madam. Among the other political, some interesting ones today, Dick Gregory's birthday is today, and he became a vegetarian. Remember, he was anti-war, those of you who remember the Vietnam War. And also the woman who invented Weight Watchers, Jean Nedich, it's her birthday today. The other interesting birthdays is Chris Wallace, who was the son of Mike Wallace, a Russian-Jewish family. Wallachinsky, I think, was the original name. And, of course, when their ancestors came, I think, through New York, although Mike Wallace is out of Chicago, or was, and I guess he's still around, a little old, long in the tooth for 60 minutes. But anyway, what the American customs and immigration people would do, if they couldn't pronounce or spell the name, they would anglicize it. So Wallachinsky became Wallace. So a lot of these Wallaces, like Irving Wallace, the author, you see lawyers named Wallace, were probably Russian Jewish or a name like Wallachinsky, something like that. Now, Wallace is also a Scotch, I think it's one of the tribes. And there was the famous Wallace in the movie, not Rob Boy, but the other one starring Mel Gibson, which was they were fighting off the Plantagenets. The English are always trying to conquer Scotland. And laid claim to it, and Edward II, or Longshanks, because he was such a big, known as a big bastard, a horrible man who tortured people and did horrible things. I think he pushed his son out a window. But anyway, inflicted horrible atrocities upon the Scotch and tortures upon William Wallace, and he's one of the heroes of Scotland. And also... George Wallace, probably the Georgia governor, and who was also an airman in World War II. And to be fair to George Wallace, we heard, I came out of the civil rights era and Vietnam era. He was lambasted and just mercilessly lacerated in the press. But what he said, and we'll get into this with the Phoenix City story on another broadcast, he had run for office. He was a poor white boy, came back from the war. And in effect, he lost the election. He says, "I'll never be, quote, out-niggered again." I think that's a correct quote. He wasn't the racist. And, you know, this is one of the myths, political fictions about the South, that a lot of us here in the North were led to believe that all white Southerners were white trash and racist and booty bandits and all of that, and abused black women, tortured and lynched black men who black males who didn't keep their place and that sort of thing. A lot of this was nonsense because even going back to the Civil War, and it's also the death of Robert E. Lee today in 1870. We'll get into that's important. That a lot of these poor white Southerners who fought in the Confederacy were not pro-slave. They were abused, too. There was economic abuse of them also. And they were just hard-scrabble people who were trying to scratch a living out of the dirt-poor earth. So these are some of the myths about the South that we need to correct. And even about that flag, it wasn't about slavery, was about states' rights, and we need to look at these things again and accurately and be fair. And of course, this gets to the Emancipation Proclamation that Lincoln had done a lot of things. So Lincoln was a railroad lawyer, even though he studied by candlelight and all of that. In those days, a railroad lawyer was to have a license to steal, and railroads were developing and going across, stealing people's land, driving the Indians off the land, driving the sheep herders and the cattlemen off the land that they wanted to lay their tracks on. But Lincoln did quite a few things that are questionable, like moving the capital in Illinois from Vandalia to Springfield. And he worked for the Illinois Central Railroad, which were a bunch of bandits in those days. Anyway, he once said that that the blacks should be transported, the Negroes should be transported back to Africa. And in the Emancipation Proclamation, this is not highlighted as much as it should be, he gave the South a deadline. He said if the South would come back into the Union at such and such a date, the slaves, they would not be freed. But if they didn't, the slaves would be free, and all the slaves who were in land and territory occupied by the Union Army would also be freed. And he also tried to get blacks, or Negroes as they were called at that time, to go to Liberia, which is still populated by descendants of American, quote, Negroes, who either voluntarily or were forced to go back to Africa. So this is one of the Lincoln myths. And, of course, some of us historians look at Lincoln cynically, and in a one way of looking at him is that John Wilkes Booth did him a favor, because had Lincoln lived, he would have certainly been impeached. And poor Andrew Johnson, took the fall for trying to carry out Lincoln's plans for reconciliation and rebuilding and reconstruction of the South. And there's a great movie out. It's a rare one. We have a copy in the library we got. Called Tennessee Johnson. It's made during World War II, starring Van Heflin. I highly recommend to see this film. And he's the only president to come back after he only served one term, and then Grant succeeded him. We know those of you who know history know the mess that Grant was way in over his head, like this guy, Mr. Rowe. But Grant was legally elected. Anyway, Johnson, after he left the White House, he was elected senator from Tennessee. He's the only president to go back to the U.S. Senate. Now, the other president, John Quincy Adams, went back as a representative after he lost Andrew Jackson. He went back from Massachusetts, from a district in Massachusetts. He was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives. Those are the only two instances in American history so far. Now, also today, death today, is that of Roger Taney in 1869. Taney was the first Catholic to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. He was from Maryland. I think you pronounce it Taney. And he was one of the longest serving and controversial in that the infamous Dred Scott Act, which was, when I researched it, it was about 30 pages, that decision. Very controversial at the time, still is controversial today. And in Taney's decision, he mentions the Native American Indians, and he put the blacks in the same category that this three-fifths of a man and a lot of other nonsense. But it's a fascinating reading. And Taney was lambasted by the abolitionists for that decision, and he died a year before Robert E. Lee. Robert E. Lee, the great general, who actually fought in the Mexican War with Grant and some of these other generals who later served in the Civil War, but they all had served in the Mexican War. And Robert E. Lee was offered the commander-in-chief of the Union Army, and he said no. He had to think about it, that his first loyalty was to the state of Virginia. He was a brilliant tactician, and had he had the resources that Grant had, we might have two separate nations on this continent, or this part of the continent. And Robert E. Lee was the first, he had slaves, I believe. And during the Civil War, Washington's house in Mount Vernon was off limits. It was sacred, and there was no fighting around it, I understand. Robert E. Lee was Episcopalian, or Anglican, and after the Civil War, the blacks were able to attend the churches that their masters had attended, but they were not to be served communion. They were still served separately. And what had happened was a black had come up to get communion and with Robert E. Lee, and the priest, the Episcopalian priest, didn't want to give him communion, but Robert E. Lee insisted upon it, and that we were now equal. So he was quite a man, they wanted one of the slogans at the time was, we're going to go to Richmond and hang Robert E. Lee and Jefferson Davis. Jefferson Davis is another guy, Secretary of War, fascinating man, and we'll get into him another day. since today is the, since we're talking about judges, this is a public policy question. We have a candidate for judicial office here in San Francisco City and County, a guy named Michael Nava, N-A-V-A, Hispanic ethnicity, homosexual activist, worked as a staff attorney in the state Supreme Court. I think I encountered him in the Steve Neri case, if my memory serves me correct. Anyway, the issue about him is he wants to be elected to push a quote heterosexual pro-gay Republican judge off the bench, and he will replace him because there are not enough Hispanics on the bench. We're going to play that card. What somebody referred to as the chili bean card. And also, there are not enough gays. We have about 10 gays and lesbians on the San Francisco bench, and most people don't know that and that's the agenda that's going on. But what makes this guy so controversial is that he writes pornography, homosexual pornography. And the question is whether should a person who run for a judgeship or political office who writes pornography, whether it's heterosexual or homosexual. And this has been covered up by the morons in the media and, of course, alternative papers. Even they've been described as gay, even though they claim they're not, such as the Bay Guardian, have endorsed this guy for that judicial seat. So the question people should be asking themselves, and this is not only applies to San Francisco, it's across the country, should a person who's applying to be elected or appointed to a public office, if that person writes pornography, whatever it is, does that disqualify them? Should that disqualify them? Is there an ethical question there? So we'll leave that. We'll see what happens in 3 weeks, so even with the vote fraud, which is going on here in San Francisco. We're going to put up the vote fraud archives that we worked on, Californians Against Voter Fraud. It will be on Amicus Veritas YouTube, AmicusVeritas. It's all documented, something you won't see anyplace else because we had access over the years to the files of the San Francisco voter registrar and Alameda County voter registrar and some other files. So, and it's very interesting. We got a question from Jack Cashel about how can you tell if a voter is a legal citizen? On the old voter registration applications, and we have several of those. I only found one or two of them. There was a big form, and it had on that form the date that you became the registrant, became a citizen, where, and I think the court was there also. So I'll put that form up, and that should answer that question. Now, the only thing you can do, all those people who are curious about people who may or may not be U.S. citizens or be legally in this country, it used to be that you could go to the clerk of the federal court and look up the immigration naturalization files, and there were little index cards which indicated the person's name, date, where they were born, and when they were naturalized as U.S. citizens. That has since been blocked. I've been unable to get to those files, or have been blocked. I don't know why. And we did get some of them a while back. So we'll try to put those up so you can see what used to be and what is not available now and should be. And maybe we should go back to a voter registration form, which does have, are you a U.S. citizen? If not, were you naturalized, and the date and where? Excuse me. So that's important. So I think these are questions that need to be asked by everybody who's concerned about the credibility of our elections. And also, this is heartening. Of all newspapers, the San Francisco Chronicle, and I won't get into all the names that they're called by their critics, but they have two interesting editorials on the propositions that are before the San Francisco voter. And two of them, and we talked about them last week, one was, should non-citizens who have kids in the public schools be allowed to vote in school board elections? And surprisingly, the San Francisco Chronicle said no, vote no on that one. And then the other one, the same day, election day registration and voting, and the Chronicle again said vote no on that one. And we've seen and we have documented, as I just said, the voter fraud that's gone on in the past and is still going on. We don't need what I call Election Day voter fraud. There's no reason with all of the absentee ballots, and I think for 30 days before an election, you can go into your voter registrar's office and up to the 30 days and register, and then 30 days, if you're registered, within the 30 days up to Election Day, even up to Election Day on that day, if you are registered, you can vote. So, and of course, you go into the voter registrar's office and do that. So there's no reason for people not to be able to vote because there's plenty of time and the facilities have made available and it's easy to do unless you're on a sick bed or whatever and you can apply for an absentee ballot. So, of course, there was fraud there too, but at least the voter registrars have made it easy for people to vote within a time frame right up to and even on Election Day. But registration on Election Day and voting on Election Day, yet. So to honor our military and the USS Cole, people who were killed, the 17 and the 39 who were injured, some of them may have been maimed for life. Of course, then they become not wards, but their medical treatment, they should get full medical care from the VA, and there's some controversy about that. And, of course, we've had people, Veterans for Constitutional Rights, have been very active over the years, volunteering their time to expose corruption in the Veterans Administration, which I understand there's still some of it going on. And Art Burnclaw, who incidentally played baseball with Ted Williams. He almost became a Red Sox ball player. But anyway, we'll have an interview with him. I got to get a hold of him, hopefully by Veterans Day. Anyway, he's been working to get veterans benefits, full veterans benefits, for veterans who have been injured and who are entitled to veterans payments from the VA. And interesting guy, Art. But anyway, I want to play this in memory of these 17 sailors who gave their lives, who were killed by these terrorists. My goodness, where is it? Excuse me. Oh, somebody on here. I'm sorry. I'm a little slow today. USS Cole, a lot of people don't know that it was named after a Marine who was killed in February 1945 off of Okinawa. And so that's who that ship was named after. We used to name our battleships after states, our aircraft carriers after battles like the Saratoga, the Lexington, I know about the Enterprise, Big E, Also, I forgot, on this day there was a race riot on the Kitty Hawk back in the 70s, and we had some problems with how minorities were treated. And it used to be, for instance, Filipinos would sign on as mess on the in the U.S. Navy and serve on the ships, and use that as a avenue to get into the U.S. Navy. But I've been hearing problems that these guys are cliquish, and they sit at the same table together and all that, and so they don't try to self-integrate. This is what I hear. I haven't been on a ship to determine that, but if they're doing that, they need to get out of this mental straitjacket and circulate, as it were. Oh, and let's see what else happened today. Yes, the first Catholic saint named who was Irish, who was I think killed or executed, Oliver Plunkett, was named a Roman Catholic saint in 1975. And then, some other things I forgot. Shame on me. In 1977, we had, since we're talking about race relations and affirmative action, the U.S. Supreme Court heard the Backe case. This was a case from University of California, Davis, white guy who claimed that his civil rights were being violated to promote this affirmative action agenda, and he lost that case, known as the Backe case. And then, again, getting back to politicians, in 1984, there was a believed to be IRA was behind this, the Irish Republican Army. Those terrorists tried to assassinate Margaret Thatcher. Now, I did bring up last week when we talked, or the last edition we talked with Mahatma Gandhi's grandnephew, that Indira Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru's daughter, was Prime Minister of India. And she was assassinated by Sikhs. And, that's not that many women have been assassinated who have been political leaders or royalty. We go back to Empress Elizabeth of Austria. She was visiting Italy after the death of her son, a love nest suicide, the Meyerling affair. And she was in Italy, and she was knifed to death by an anarchist. And she was the wife of Franz Joseph, the longest-reigning Austrian emperor, and one of the longest-reigning in history, of the males anyway. I think Catherine the Great reigned longer, and I think Victoria may have also. And then also there was a woman official in Nevada who was assassinated, and then I think there was one other. Oh, yeah, the Grand Duke, getting back to the Austrians, the Grand Duke Ferdinand, Archduke Ferdinand, who was to be the successor to Franz Joseph, and he wanted to modernize Austria. Him and his wife, Sophie, were assassinated in Sarajevo, and that triggered the World War I, and we're still dealing with that mess. So I want to end today with, in honor of the 17 sailors that died and those who were, and this is for those who died. There was a couple things I forgot to mention, which are along this line. In 1915, a British nurse, Edith Cavell, C-A-V-E-L-L, was accused of being a spy in Belgium, and she was executed by the Germans, by the Kaiser Wilhelm's people. Also, the French got even. Matahari, who was Indonesian or something, nobody could determine her race. So she was a spy for the Germans, and she was tried and executed by the French. And she used to seduce people and all of that, quite a woman. And one of the big mysterious women in history, femme fatale, I guess you would call it. So these are the things that, well, there's a couple other things, I guess I should bring them up. The inventor of the raincoat, Charles McIntosh, was born today. Or no, he invented it in 1873. And then the when they were carving up China, we still have that problem today, the British and the French military expeditionary forces captured Peking, or what is known as Beijing today. And in 1915, getting back to this period, and it's an issue that comes up in immigration today, Teddy Roosevelt brought up this issue, the conflict, as he saw it, of dual nationalities, where we had people who were have American citizenship and Irish citizenship, or the countries that allow this dual citizenship. I don't believe it should be allowed, and we have this problem with judges. I mean, my phrase is, how can a man serve two masters? Not only does one of them get shortchanged, but loses his shorts as well. So that's something to think about. And, of course, we're headed toward 21 days, the countdown to the November 2010 elections. And, of course, this is very apropos to that.
What do you say, Ben? Want a hand?
No, you guys go ahead. I got too much on my mind to play poker.
King bet.
Cost you five. Tony, up to you.
Say, Tony, what are you
going to
do?
I'm in.
So am I.
Gentlemen, here we are, and one thing is clear. We gotta pick a candidate for Congress this year.
Big ace.
Ace bet.
You'll pay through the nose.
Okay, where do you stand?
I'm in.
So am I.
Likewise.
Here goes.
Possible straight, possible flush. Nothing.
Gentlemen, how about some names we can use? Some qualified Republican who's willing to lose.
How's it going? We should make Jack Riley the guy.
Which Riley are you thinking of, Jack P or Jack Y?
I say neither one. I never even met him.
I say when you got a pair of Jack, bat out.
Politics and poker, shuffle up the cards and find the joker. Need a game for children, need a game in luck. Decisions, decisions, like
who to
pick,
how to play, what's
the call
of the... All right now, fellas, politics or poker, which is more important?
Paraphrase.
Bet 'em.
Little trade, good as gold.
I'll say.
Raise your mind.
I'll call.
I'll hold.
I'll raise your back.
I think you're bluffing.
Put your money where your mouth is.
Okay, I'm in.
Gentlemen, knock it off and let's get this done.
Try Michael Fajicinkovich. I'm certain he'd run.
Mike is out. I'm afraid he just wouldn't sell. Nobody likes a candidate whose name they can't spell.
How about Dave Zimmerman?
Davey's too bright.
What about Walt Gustafson?
Walt died last night.
How about Frank Monahan?
What about George Gale?
Frank ain't a citizen and George is in jail.
We could run out Wallenstein.
He's only 23.
What about Ed Peterson?
You idiot!
Politics and poker, politics and poker, play for a pot and
YouTube site, AMICUSVERTAS. Good night.